about our father Yitzchak and the times that he lived in and the type of personality that he was. Out of all of the Ovos, first of all, let me say a caveat that even though I discuss the Ovos in human terms and I ascribe to them descriptions that all of us can understand, and nevertheless, the Ovos were superior people who really are beyond our kind of understanding. They're beyond our measure. But since the Torah and the Talmud and the Midrashim speak of them in terms of human understanding the way we would talk about people, so I also use that tone and those types of statements. But it would be wrong to say that Yitzchak is your everyday neighbor, or it'd be wrong to say that Yitzchak is even the finest rabbi that you know, or the greatest Rosh Yeshiva. Because as the Talmud says, "Rishonim k'malachim onuti b'nei adam." If the earlier generations were angels, then we're human beings. But if they were only human beings, then we are not even human beings. We're donkeys. We're not even pious donkeys. And that said about people who were Tanoim, the Gemara is speaking about. What shall we say about the Ovos? About people who transcended all generations. So that caveat has to be understood, especially has to be understood regarding the discussion of Yitzchak. Because Yitzchak is the most complex and mysterious of the three of us. Avraham Avinu, especially after my great lecture on him, he's understood to all, right? We feel that we have some understanding of him. And Yaakov Avinu, so we can identify with him and his human problems and the historic problems that emanate. And the Chumash itself spends a great deal of space on both Avraham and Yaakov. On Yitzchak, relatively speaking, there is little said. And what is said is in terms of Avraham to Yitzchak and in terms of Esav and Rivka and Yaakov to Yitzchak. But in terms of Yitzchak, very little is said. And he remains, therefore, a mysterious person, an unknown person. One of the three great Ovos, but one whose personality and the times that he lived in are very difficult to trace. So I'm going to attempt, in the words that I have to say here, to give you some sort of portrayal as seen through the eyes of Chazal, basically, with the backdrop of what happened in the Middle East, and especially in the land of Israel during the time that he lived there. Our rabbis tell us that Yitzchak resembled his father in every way, physically. They had the same face. And our rabbis phrase it because they say the Leitzonei Ador, the mockers of the generation said, how could it be that Avraham had a child, he's so old? It must be that Sarah had the child from someone else. The fact that Sarah was also so old. But that's why the Medrash says, Leitzonei Ador, the mockers. A mocker, it doesn't, somebody who makes fun, it doesn't have to make sense. You don't even have to think it's true. But one good joke, one good piece of mockery can undo generations of civilization. And we are all liable to jokes, and many times a joke destroys. So they said, well, how could it be that Avraham gave birth to him? Avraham's an old man. So God, so to speak, made it that it was clear to all that Avraham, holiness Yitzchak, that Avraham was the father of Yitzchak. They had the same face. They had the exact same face. They resembled each other intimately. And rabbis say that Yitzchak was a very handsome man. He had the beauty of Yosef, as we'll see later that Yosef was one of the handsomest of men. All the Ovos were very handsome men, Yaakov Avinu as well. Yosef was especially handsome. It says in the Torah of Yosef, Oyifas Torah, Yifas Marit, that he had beautiful features and a very attractive countenance. And Yitzchak was his predecessor in that. He had that genetic pattern from his grandfather Yitzchak. Yitzchak was also a very powerful person, as I mentioned to you last time. Avraham Avinu was a powerful person physically. Strong, large person. Yitzchak also was a very powerful person, very strong. Yet we find that Yitzchak never exercised his strength in the way that his father did. He never went to war the way Avraham Avinu did. He never really stood up to the bullies the way Avraham Avinu did. We see that Yitzchak also has trouble with Abimelech, the king of the Philistines. And they lived along the coast, and when there was a hunger in the midst of in the middle of Eretz Israel, so he emigrated towards the coast, thinking that perhaps he would go to Egypt, as his father had gone to Egypt. Egypt never suffered from drought because of the Nile. It suffered, there were times when the Nile failed, but as long as the Nile would not fail, then the Egyptian bread basket, which was the bread basket in the Middle East, always was present. So he thought he would go to Egypt, as his father had gone to Egypt. However, on the way to Egypt, God appears to him and tells him, no, stay, don't go to Egypt. And he stays in the land of Abimelech, where he becomes accustomed to the conditions of the country, and he becomes very successful. He finds water, he digs wells, he finds the water wells that his father had dug before him. And what happens to him, and this is, I think, the key to the story of Yitzchak as far as the Chumash is concerned, is that Yitzchak is not so much history as historiography. He's not so much what happened as the pattern of history. The pattern of Yitzchak's life is the pattern of the Jewish people. That's what makes Yitzchak the special one of the Ovos. Because even though all of the Ovos are Maise Ovos Simul Avonim, all of the stories of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are indicative, really, of what would happen to the Jewish people, especially the life of Jacob. But the life of Yitzchak, more than any of the other Ovos, contains all of the elements of the Jewish story, as I hope we'll see in the next few moments. All of the elements of the Jewish story are contained. So here's one element, that he comes to a strange country, and he digs wells, and he finds wells that his father had dug before him, and he brings prosperity to the country. It's a time of drought. Water is the most precious of all commodities. What can be of greater value than water? And he finds water, and the Philistines stop them up. They fill the wells. They don't want the water. Better to have drought than Jewish water. Lest you think I exaggerate, in 1967, my wife and I were privileged to visit Eretz Israel about 2.5 months after the Six-Day War. And we were shown then a warehouse in East Jerusalem, which was still filled then, with cases of the Salk polio vaccine. And then the boxes, it said, a gift from the people of the United States. And all of this polio vaccine was given to Jordan, but it was not used by the Jordanians, even though polio existed. And there was even an epidemic 2 years before, because of the fact that the man who discovered it was a Zionist. And they were, you know, it's like, from the sublime to the ridiculous, right? You weren't allowed to show Elizabeth Taylor movies because she was a Jewess, right? Nayan, Sadekis. And you weren't allowed to use the Salk vaccine because it's just so better that Arab children should have polio than that they should say that they have something from the Zionist entity. That's the story of the Plishtim with the water. better to go thirsty and better to have a drought than to acknowledge that the wells, that they owe something to Abraham, that they owe something to Yitzhak. That's what I mean by historiography. It's not the story of history, it's the story, the pattern of all history, of what is going to be, not only what was. And Avimelech tells that to Yitzchak, Lech, leave us, ki otzamto mimenu, you made too much money off of us. The fact that Yitzchak developed the country, the fact that if it would not have been for Yitzchak, the country would have been barren and backwards, and Yitzchak developed it, that made no difference. He told them, now go. You should be thankful that we're letting you go alive. Ki otzamto, you became wealthy mimenu, from us. It's our money that you have taken. Well, is that not the story of the Jewish people throughout its long exile? Where the Jewish people have developed and nurtured every society that they have been in and enriched it in physical and spiritual and mental terms, and then there comes a day, goodbye. Just take it and leave. We don't want you anymore. Well, that's a very, very strong lesson that the Chumash wants to tell us. And the lesson of Avimelech is a lesson that should not be lost upon us. We see Yitzchak's reaction, though. Avraham Avinu, it says, Vayochach Avraham es Avimelech. Avraham, he told them off. He said to him, listen, you're a thief. How dare your men behave that way? Yitzchak, we don't find a strong reaction. Yitzchak moves. They took the first well they ruined, he moved. The second well they moved. The third well, he moved. Finally, he comes to a well, Rehovot, and there is no contest, so he says, good, right? Now it's good for us, because there's enough room for all of us in the land. Now, Yitzchak is seen already as the placid, long-suffering Jew. The Jew that is not necessarily going to stand up for his rights, so to speak. He takes a very low profile. And is not looking for a fight with Avimelech, even when he's right and Avimelech is wrong, even though Yitzchak knows that he has the promise of God that he will protect him. He nevertheless is not ready for open contest, he's not ready for confrontation, he's not pushing. Now that's not a very heroic pose. We don't like that. It doesn't meet our standards of macho. Like the U.S. cavalry coming in a charge at the end of the movie to win the war. But Yitzchak is the picture of the long-suffering Jew, which at times is the only choice that Jews have had. Many times people always say when we read Jewish history and we look back at it, why didn't the Jews do this? Why didn't they do that? Why didn't they stand up? Why didn't they revolt? Well, all of those questions are not only moot, most of the time they are ill-founded because the circumstances are such that they could do nothing. Just as the Nazis and the elimination of the Jews in Europe, the Jews were essentially helpless. Their individual acts of heroism, the entire battle for the Warsaw Ghetto, etc., there are individual chapters, but generally speaking they could do nothing. Isolated, alone, driven, hunted, without a friend in the face of the earth, one is very limited. And because of that, therefore, it is the image of Yitzchak that takes over. I think generally, without overstating the case, Yitzchak could be identified as the survivor in Jewish life. Because he, out of all of the Avos, he went on the Akedah. He actually stretched his throat to the knife. In fact, the words of the Medrash are that he died. The Medrash says, in the Pirkei Reb Elezer, the Medrash says that when the sword touched his throat, he actually died. His soul left him. But that when the angel said, don't harm your son, so then the soul returned to him. So therefore, and the Pirkei Rav Elazar says that Yitzchak is the one that is the author who composed the bracha Baruch Ato Hashem Mechaye Amesi. Blessed are you, our God, who revives the dead. So it's not who revives the dead in a theoretical form, but Yitzchak felt that he was revived from the dead. And that's the symbol of Yitzchak. All of his life, Yitzchak is haunted by that moment. That's a trauma that does not easily depart from him. We have it in a different way, but I think in the same strong impression. If you speak to people who were in the Holocaust, who spent years under the Nazis and who survived, so even though they survived and now they've built themselves back and they have families and they have children, they have grandchildren, they have successful businesses, whatever they have, but that trauma has never left them. Not only never left them, the psychology majors are doing theses on their children and grandchildren. How the children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors are different. So their psychological makeup is different. Their behavior patterns are different, etc. That must be. That goes without saying. Because the trauma of being on the Akedah is not something that is forgotten. It's not something that can ever be forgotten. And that perhaps colors the behavior of Yitzchak in general regarding all of the events that we find in the Chumash. Because we stand back amazed at many of the things that happen in the Chumash. Yitzchak's favoritism for Esau. How he does not see what is so obvious, that Esau will destroy him. And his only hope is in Yaakov. Yitzchak's passivity generally in front of Abimelech and others. The fact that Yitzchak essentially is a very private figure. Our rabbis say, the Medrash phrases it, that the Rabboni Shalom saw that Yitzchak was embarrassed to come out in the world because of the fact that he had Esau. So God blessed him, that's the Lashon of the Medrash, God blessed him with being blind so he could stay home. So he wouldn't have to face the world. So in that, there's also part of the Akedah. Our rabbis say, where did he become blind? Who made him blind? So he was blind from the Akedah. He said the Yitzchak lay on the altar and the tears of the angels fell in his eyes. Our rabbis say it in a most striking fashion. That, as the Targum Yonason Benazil and Bereishis, it says that Avraham Avinu only looked in the eyes of his son Yitzchak when he came to kill him. But Yitzchak looked in the eyes of the angels. Yitzchak saw the angels, Abraham did not see them. Yitzchak saw the trauma. He's, after all, the victim. So even though we ascribe the test of the Akedah to Avraham, as it was, and even though Avraham receives the credit, Yitzchak is the one that essentially is the survivor of the Akedah. And that's an important point to remember because it colors all of his life. It influences all of his decisions. It makes everything that he does more understandable to us, and that's how the Medrash saw it. That's how Chazal saw it. Now, Yitzchak, apparently the Talmud also tells us, Yitzchak was an only child born to a very elderly, doting couple. So that also is something that goes with it. I remember when I went to school, public school, so even though I was also practically an only child, and my mother, Alei Hashalom, was a very doting mother, but I had great independence compared to one or two of my classmates who until fifth or sixth grade, their mother would, she would bring them to school every morning and bring lunch to them. And the kid, when he was 12, 13 years old, still, the mother never let go of it. Which is understandable, but that can have a very stunting effect upon the child. psychologically and physically. Again, it would be impossible for us to say it except the Medrash says it. The Medrash says that Avraham Avinu, when he came to take Yitzchak to the Akedah, so he said to Sarah, he said, listen, he says, my chinuch began when I was 3 years old. I left home. That's based on the idea that I discussed with you that Avraham Avinu, when he was 3 years old already, hikir es boro, he outgrew the idolatry of his father's house. His education began when he was young. He said, and this child, he says, he's 37 years old. He's never been to the yeshiva yet. That's the lushan that the Medrash uses. Lo holach lo lebeis ha-medrash ve lo lebeis ha-talmud. So naturally he was educated in Avraham's house. But she wouldn't let him go to Shem Vaker. She wouldn't let him go to the, you know, to leave home, which is again understandable, right? An only child given miraculously in old age. And so he said to her, I have a place that's not far from us. I'm going to take him. He's old enough to go. And that's how he takes the child away, even though the child is not a child. The child is a grown adult. He takes him away from his mother. And I think that that's what the Medrash means, that the Sultan came to her and told her, you know, he didn't take him to school. He's taking him out in the world. He's going to kill him. And that killed Sora. Sora did not survive. She didn't wait to hear the end of the story, that Yitzhak survived. But Porcho Nishmoso, she dies immediately. Because he's her little boy, no matter what. And Yitzhak has that in him. Our rabbis say again, and no one could say it except that our rabbis say it, that Yitzhak was spoiled. Yitzhak was a child that had everything. And he was, the rabbis say, why did he like the good food at Esau? How does it come that he says, you know, bring me the good food? So our rabbis say, because he was used to eating like that, right? He never, his mother made him steak every night. She gave him, getting good fat food to eat, right? Whatever he liked. And that's the lashon that Rivka says, because Rivka continued to treat her husband in the fashion that he as a son had been treated by his mother. So she said, I'll make for you good food that your father, I mean, it's not shaykh if Yitzchak loves good food. Yitzchak's not a gourmet, he's not a restaurant critic. It's like he's the Ola Tmima, he's the holy man of God. But the Chumash and the Medrash come to reveal to us the human quality that was here. The human quality was here that he was always life accustomed to good food. His mother made for him, you know, she ran a restaurant for him. What do you want tonight, my child? The angel food came there. So that also is part of his personality. It's also part of his makeup. And that's what makes Yitzchak, again, so complicated for us to deal with. Chazal tell us that Yitzchak was so passive that even when it came to the story of Joseph and his brothers, Yitzchak was still alive when it happened. When Joseph was sold by his brothers into captivity, Yitzchak was still alive. Yitzchak, out of all the ovos, lived the longest period of time. He lived to be 180 years old. So he was still alive. And he knew the story. He knew that Yosef was still alive. And he did not reveal it to his son. He did not reveal it to Yaakov. And again, the language that's used is HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo gilo lo. God didn't tell him. Ani magala lo. Should I tell him? So it's not a question of right or wrong here. But again, it's a question of the personality that we see here. The non-interference, the passivity, and the trusting in God to such an extent that you know, God wants to tell him, the God will tell him. One would think that an ordinary father would be unable to withhold himself under any circumstances to see the pain of his son and to realize the family problem, etc. And Yitzhak holds back. The whole matter, he holds back. Now the main area of Yitzchak deals with his relationship to Esau, which is again an approach regarding the Jewish people that's very, very difficult for us to understand or certainly to follow. It says that Yitzchak could not see well, that he was blind. So our rabbis imply that is, was not only a physical fact, as it was, that let's say he had cataracts, that he Yitzchak, that Yitzchak became old, batichenu einov merotz, his eyes dimmed, and he was no longer able to see. That's a fact. That's a simple fact. He had cataracts or whatever, eye disease, and he couldn't see. But the entire thrust of the Medrash and the entire thrust of rabbinic thought on the matter is that he was not only blind in terms of physical sight, but he just didn't see. He didn't see a way out for himself and his family from all of the surroundings. He didn't see how he would survive having Esau and his family as part of the Jewish people. He didn't see that Yaakov would be able to triumph. He just didn't see. He's a sightless person, as the Medrash phrases it. And the Medrash says very, very harsh things, again, regarding his being sightless. First of all, the Medrash, the Gemara, says in Megillah, that the curse of Abimelech against Sarah became fulfilled. Because after all, Abraham and Sarah did, to a certain extent, entrap him or fool him. Because he said, she's my sister. Everything Abraham said was true. But a lot of times in life, everything you say is true, but the truth is not being said. Truth and true statements don't always add up to the same thing. So what happened was that Abimelech said to Sarah, Hine hu loch ksusenai. He, Abraham, is a cover for your eyes. So the simple explanation is that he's your protector. But a cover for your eyes, our rabbi saw in that a curse. And they said that Yitzchak went blind because Abimelech cursed him through his mother. And because he said, Ksusenayim, there'll come a day that you also won't be able to see. You fooled me. I didn't see what was happening. I didn't see that he was your husband. Right, it was my fault. I shouldn't have behaved the way I behaved. Everything is right. But nevertheless, I was fooled. I was tricked. I was deceived. I couldn't see. So there'll come a day you won't see either. From that, the Gemara means to show us in all of its awesome clarity how exacting the measure of God's justice is. And that many times things happen to people and they say, why did it happen to me? What is it? You know, nobody knows why. But if we were able to read God's book, so to speak, and look at it, we'd say, oh, you know, that's right. You know, 50 years ago I said this, or 100 years ago my grandfather said that. And now it's all come home to roost. it's a different the Jewish method of analyzing situations and history and personalities and family life, etc., is far different than the normal way of looking at things. And if it's that way, God forbid, for evil, it's certainly that way multiplied many times for good. So that was one point Yitzchak couldn't see. The Medrash says, the Zohar says, Vatichena Einov, why did his eyes go blind? What did it mean he couldn't see? Misha Oev L'Rishoyim Kach Sofa. What a Lushan in the Zohar, what a frightening thing. So he loved the Russia, it was his son. He couldn't see. What the Zohar means is obviously that love blinds people. If you have any doubts, come to parent-teacher conferences. But my kid, you know, he's hanging from the chandelier, he's destroying the class. My kid, you know, the teacher's no good. School's no good. You don't know how to reach him, Rebbe. You know how to reach him, you know? The kid, meanwhile, is a holy terror that's uncontrollable. Destroys the class, the school, etc. Now, you have to understand the parent, right? You have to sympathize with the parent. In fact, you may be the parent, right? That also can be in life. God's infinite sense of humor works on all of us. But there's an objectivity that's required. Ahavo mekalkelis es ashura, the Talmud says. Love. Just as hatred destroys all objectivity, love also destroys all objectivity. If a person cannot be objective, then he loses himself somehow. One has to be objective even regarding one's children. So the Zohar says, Mishoeg l'rishoyim, he has a son that's a Russia. It's not his fault, he did the best, etc. But at the end, the bottom line is that Esav is what? A murderer. Esav's a rapist. Esav's a robber. That's the bottom line. So then he should not have been blinded by it. And being blinded by it, so that's what Tichenu, you know, his eyes are blind. Couldn't see. Esav generally is the problem. I quote a very felicitous phrase which is used. Esav is the problem of non-Jewish Jews, which is a serious problem in Jewish history and in Jewish life, even today. There are non-Jewish Jews who do us tremendous harm. But because they come from the house of Yitzhak and Rivka, and because they're Jewish in background, their behavior reflects upon us. They're able to destroy us. They're able to ruin us. They're able to influence us. And they take a piece of Yitzhak and Rivka with them. And it's very, very hard to deal with. I need not cite you examples, but there are many examples in history. Heine, Marx, Disraeli, there are all sorts of non-Jewish Jews floating around. Ilya Ehrenberg, Trotsky. I don't want to mention the non-Jewish Jews whom I know, because they may yet become Jewish. But it's a terrible problem. And what do you do with that? So you write them out of the Jewish people. First of all, nobody gave us the authority to write people out. Even if we write them out, they're not out, right? Spinoza. We wrote Spinoza out. Spinoza remains a Jew till today. Spinoza's come back to haunt us 100 times, even after throwing them out. And Yitzchak had the experience of his brother Yishmael, who was thrown out of the house by Avraham and Sarah, and with disastrous results. So even though Yishmael returned in tshuva at the end, but the house of Yishmael remained forever inimical to the Jewish people. The struggle that we have today with our cousins, with the Arabs, that's just an encore. That's a continuation of the ancient struggle. Nothing new has occurred. It's just, you know, it's like Acts 68. Still at it. So that was part of his experience, Yitzchak. So he didn't want to do that with Esau. He wanted somehow to hold Esau. Yitzchak also saw in Esau, our rabbis explained to us, sometimes you have somebody that has great talent, you know, and he's a great person. Imagine, you know, if you could have Napoleon as an Orthodox Jew, or Alexander the Great, or Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar at least had a Jewish name. Imagine if they were, you know, so it would be terrific. He would be, in the yeshiva, we always used to say, you know, that if the White Sox had a Shomer Shabbos third baseman, right, that would do more for Orthodox Jewry than anything else. That's when we were young, we felt that way. I don't feel that way now. The designated hitter, maybe. Esau was that person. If Esau would have turned out, so then you would have, that's it. Then the world would have been ours. Combination military genius, great organizer, charismatic personality, a person of strong feelings, and of personal great strength and courage, strongly motivated, an aggressive, go-getting person. I mean, that would be terrific. And on top of it, you know, he's a religious Jew and he's a Mentheir. It's just terrific, right? Why did the Mentheir always have to be 4'8" and a runt? Yeah, well, imagine, right? Lawrence Taylor. That's what Yitzchak had hoped. That was part of his hope, part of his attitude. Rivka, his wife, who came from the house of Lavan, and who was aware of what Rishoyim looked like, and was aware of the fact that there comes a point in time when it becomes intractable. It just can't go back anymore. And that there comes a time to cut one's losses, so to speak, just as there's a time in business to cut one's losses. So there's a famous phrase, you know, not to throw good money after bad. So there's a time with people also. There's a time when one has to cut one's losses. There's no use. You can't do it anymore. And she came to the point. Yitzchak never came to the point. And that is part of his personality. And that's part of the message for the Jewish people to all of the ages. I don't know how to translate that message for our age. Don't get me wrong. I have no prescriptions. I don't know how to take it and apply it. But I do know that the message is here somehow. And that he was unable to be successful. And to a certain extent, we also we don't know how to deal with it. Just frightened. It says that, again, these are all things that we would not be privileged to say if the rabbis had not expressed. The rabbis wanted us to have this picture so that we should understand it clearly. It says in the Medrash, in the Bereishis Rabba, that Yitzchak said to Esau that Voyok Asher Tori, when your brother will no longer perform as he should, as Jacob, and he'll go down, then you'll go up, then you'll be able to rule the world. So the Medrash says that Yitzchak said to him, "Im ro'isa achicha porek ol Torah me'ola," if you see that your brother Yaakov no longer observes the Torah, you see that he rebels against the Torah, he's no longer interested in his mission from Sinai, gzora lo shmodim, then you pass decrees against him, you get on his back. And you'll be able to rule him. Our rabbis say Yitzchak always is representative of the Midas Hadin. Midas Hadin means the measure of judgment. The measure of judgment is of such a nature that he said, listen, if they don't want to keep the Torah, then it's free game. You do what you want with it. Well, that's what the Midas Hadin does say. And that's what happens and has happened, unfortunately, many times in Jewish life, that the Midas HaDin takes hold, the measure of judgment takes hold of us, and we are literally sheep before the wolves. We are without protection. God, Kaviyochel, removes his protective hand from us. So Yitzchak said that to him. I give you a sign when you'll be able to rule over him. So the Medrash says, that's why it says in the Novi Yeshayo, in the prophet Isaiah, it says the Pasuk, Ki Avraham lo yodanu v'Yisrael lo yakiren. Avraham doesn't know the Jewish people, and Yaakov will not recognize him. So the Medrash says, V'Yitzchon heichanu, how come Yitzchak is not in the Pasuk? It says that Avraham and Yaakov, doesn't say Yitzchak. What happened to Yitzchak? So the Medrash says, a frightening thing, the Medrash says, Mishu omer lo gzor lo shmodi, a person that said about us, about the Jewish people, that passed decrees against us, you know, give us a hard time, you have a chance to win now. Ato machtifo lovos, you want him to make him as one of our forefathers, we don't want to accept him so easily. Frightening message. Yitzchak gave Esav the idea. So Yitzchak gave it to him because he's Midas HaDin. Yitzchak gave it to him because he's the measure of judgment. And the Jewish people deserve it, they deserve it. But the Jewish people don't see it. The Jewish people resent, so to speak, that our father spoke in those terms about us, gave that idea to our brother, who has turned out to be our blood enemy, who has attempted to annihilate us so many times. We resent it, and therefore the Navi doesn't quote it. In the 63rd chapter, the Navi Yeshayo, in the 16th Pasuk, the Navi doesn't mention Yitzchak. The Medrash says that. Because that's, again, a reflection of the rigidity of Yitzchak's character, the strength that he had, and why, therefore, he felt that Esau was also entitled to something. The rabbis say, again, almost bitterly, that Avraham left to Yitzchak everything, his wealth, his blessings. He gave him everything. He gave him not only the world to come, he gave him this world also. And Yitzchak in turn gave Yaakov, in the words of the Medrash, nothing. He didn't give him any. When Yaakov left, he left penniless. He was driven from home. He did not have his father's protection. He did not have his father's wealth. All the wealth that Yaakov achieved, he achieved on his own. When will I do it for myself? Yaakov is the self-made person. Yitzchak didn't give it to him. Yitzchak gave it to Esau. He gave this world to Esau. And he expected that somehow the Jewish people, Yaakov, would make it even though this world belonged to Esau. That was, to a certain extent, we have made it, but that's a harsh set of circumstances that we have to operate on. Finally, regarding the story of Yitzchak and Esav, it says, "Vayecharad Yitzchak." Yitzchak trembled. Yitzchak was terrorized. He was frightened beyond words when Esav came for his blessing, because then he realized that he gave the blessing to Yaakov, and he gave, and Esav is here now to demand his. So again, in the words of the Medrash, Yoser me'acharoda shal gabi amizbeach. He was more frightened than the terror that he had when he was the victim of the Akedah. Because our rabbis translate the terror that when Esav came in, so it says that when Esav came in, all Gehenna opened in front of him. Smelled from Gehenna, it smelled from hell. Even though Esav, undoubtedly when he came in, Esav wore at least, some sweet-smelling cologne. Esav for certain didn't smell bad. And Yaakov was wearing the goat skin, so Rashi says there is no smell that is as offensive, no fragrance that is as obnoxious to the nose as the hide of goats. But Yaakov smelled from Gan Eden, the inner fragrance of a person of worth. So he smells of paradise. And the smell of Esau, even if it is masked by all of the perfumes in the world, is essentially the smell of hell. And that was the terror that Yitzchak felt. Yitzchak felt all of a sudden, what happened here? Our rabbis say that here he had the realization, finally, of who Esau was. God revealed it to him. And that's why it says, Vayecharad Yitzchak harada gedola admo. That's why he was so terrorized, so frightened, more than he was frightened on the altar. He was frightened by the fact that he saw what Esau really was. He saw the cruelty. He saw the murders. He saw it. And that appalled him. It appalled him that it should come from his son, that it should be part of him. In the long process of the Jewish people, and this again is historiography, in the long pattern of Jewish history, you find, I don't know how to put it gently, but you find that the Jewish people, to a certain extent, keep on expelling people from their midst. Groups of people. There's just a constant fallout over the centuries, over the millennia. Beginning the Hanukkah season, beginning from the Hellenists, who were at one time close to half of the Jewish people. What happened to them? All disappeared. Over all the ages, all the millions and millions of people who have left us and have somehow disappeared. It's as though there is something in the organism of the Jewish people that repels and excludes those that are not going to be part of it. It's a terrible, terrible vision. It's a frightening vision. And Esau is the first of that vision. Esau is the first one, because after all, Yishmael came from our father Abraham, but his mother was Hagar. But Esau comes from Rivka and Yitzchak. Esau has the same genetic makeup that Yaakov has. He has the exact same pattern. He's a twin. And therefore, it's hard to digest the fact that Esau is going to be excluded, as he is. He's going to be excluded from the Jewish people and go a different way completely. But that has happened so many times in Jewish history that it has become the pattern. Painful and unfair as that is, but that is the pattern. That's the way it works. That's the way the Jewish people look. I have mentioned many times that at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, there were approximately 12 million Jews in the world. Today, over 1900 years later, there are approximately 13 million Jews in the world. And to put that into better perspective, when the Jews were 10, 11 million people, the best estimates were that the Chinese were 4 million people. Today, there are 1,200,000,000 Chinese. And there still are only about 13 million people that are Jewish. A large proportion of that can be attributed to the persecution that has been our lot, to the fact that the Jewish people have always suffered such terrible persecution that it takes its toll. It takes its toll in numbers, enormous toll in numbers. Our own generation, we almost were 19 million people. Now we're down to 13 million people. In the last 50 years, we've suffered a loss of 6 million. And according to the statistics, may they prove to be wrong, but according to the statistical projections, the Jewish people will become even smaller over the next few decades, God forbid. Well, that is the persecution aspect, but there's another aspect to it. And the other aspect to it is the assimilation, simply the expulsion from the midst of the Jewish people of great numbers of Jews who no longer function as Jews, as I mentioned before, non-Jewish Jews, who eventually just become non-Jewish, period. No connection. No connection whatsoever. And there are millions of such people. I would say most of the country of Spain are descended from such people. I think there's Jewish blood in almost every Spaniard, if you go back far enough. And who knows what is true in other countries? Who knows what's true here? It's just so so far-flung, such a part of us, that it has that problem with it. Well, that Esav is the example of it. Rivka sees it, and, so to speak, bites the bullet and is willing to do it. Yitzchok also sees it. Vayecharad Yitzchok harodo gdola. Great terror comes upon him, great fright. You just can't imagine how he will deal with it. But he sees it at the end. He sees that that is what's happening, and he has almost no way out of it. Let's only say a few words, if I may, regarding the times that Yitzchok lived in. Compared to the time of our father Avram, it was a less turbulent time. The Canaanite Empire in the land of Canaan had solidified itself. And the great raging wars that existed during the time of Avraham Avinu, wars that lasted 25 years, as the war between the four kings and the five kings, those types of wars did not exist during his time. And you had the Hittite, the Phoenicians, and the Canaanites, all of whom formed a large group of people, a powerful group of people, who developed merchant trade, who developed sea routes, and who essentially built upon the civilization of the past generations. Egypt was the sleeping giant. Egypt was just preparatory to becoming the major empire in the world, and it would become the major empire under the grandson of Yitzchok, under Yosef. And the Egyptian commerce, the Egyptian wealth, the Egyptian influence, and the Egyptian intellect still had not come north. It still had not crossed the Sinai, so to speak. So that Israel, the land of Israel, remained the buffer. It remained the dividing line between the northern Phoenician Empire and between the Egyptian Empire. And Yitzchak, in his time, did not suffer the vicissitudes of the wars that occurred during the time of his father. I think a lot of it had to do also with the destruction of Sodom and Amorah, because they were a very strong city-states, and they were a counterbalance to the Canaanites, and their destruction, so then the competition within the country decreased. And when that happened, so there was less room for war, there was less room for those troubles to occur. Yitzchok also, one of the questions that's always asked is, what happened to all of the people that Avraham Avinu brought to the stage of monotheism? As I mentioned to you in the previous lecture, the Meiri says that Avraham Avinu brought half the world, half the civilized world by the time of his death. Had accepted the tenets and the ideas of monotheism and had given up paganism. Yitzchok, as can be seen from the personality description that I have tried to convey here in Chazal, did not have his father's power in that matter. He did not push it. He did not expand upon it. And spiritual matters, just like business matters, if you don't expand the business, then the business contracts. Nothing remains static. Nothing remains exactly the way it was. And what happened during the time of Yitzchak was that there was a slow erosion. The erosion of faith and of followers, of people that were loyal to the ideas of Abraham, as Avraham departed, so that charisma was ended. That generation was ended. And it had to be reworn again. And it wasn't to the extent that it had been during the time of Avraham. Also, and that I think this also is crucial in a matter, and the rabbis pointed out to us, is that the existence of Esau was a great hindrance to Yisrael. Because people always say, you know, one of the great banes of Rabbonim is if they have children that are uncontrollable. Right? Bring your kid to shul and he doesn't sit. Right? He's running, he's jumping, he's tearing the siddurim, he gets in fights, etc., etc. Very hard to be a rabbi with a kid like that. So I, Baruch Hashem, was blessed with different children, but I know many rabbis that are blessed with the other kind of children. And in our own family, we know, you know, some of our family members who are Rosh Yeshiva, etc., I mean, they had kids that were terrors until they were 15 or whatever, just terrors. So people say, you know, listen, I mean, why should I listen to what he has to say? Look at his kid. Right? He's telling me how to educate a child. He's telling me how to raise a child. He's telling me what to look at his kid, right? And that's a terrible problem to overcome. Not easily overcome under any circumstances. Esau stands in the way of Yitzhak's success. The rest of the world says, hey, you know what? Look at his tzatzke. Look what that guy looks like. And because of that, therefore, there are inhibitions to Yitzhak which don't exist previously. At the time of Avraham. Our rabbis say that even regarding Yishmael, so it says that as long as Avraham lived, Alpnei Kol Echav Shochein, he dwelt with all of his brothers. He wasn't the wild animal yet, as long as his father was alive. It's only after his father died, so then it says Alpnei Kol Echav Nochol, then he fell upon everyone. So as long as Avraham Avinu was alive, so that the Avraham didn't suffer from having the burden of having a child like Esau, whereas Yitzchak did. So in that combination of events and that combination of problems, we see the personality of Yitzchak as Chazal wanted us to see it. And we see that in essence what he did was conserve the gains of his father, be the transitional bridge till the generation of Yaakov and really the development of the family of the Jewish people. And he was the one who sacrificed himself as the Ola Tmima, as the perfect sacrifice on the altar. He sacrificed himself literally and figurative. But nevertheless, he remains, as we began, a most enigmatic figure, a person that it's very difficult for us to really get a clear understanding of him. The Chumash and all the records of the time, the other records also, it's all shrouded in mystery. And because of the peculiar problems, it's as though the Chumash wanted to do so purposely. But from the general pattern that emerges from the Midrashim and from Chazal, from the Talmud itself, I think we have a clearer picture of the personality and of the times and the influence he had, and if perhaps out of all of the Ovos, he is the Maase Ovos Simon Labonim. It is his life that is most representative of what later will be Jewish history. Most of us always think that Jacob is the exemplary life because he goes into exile, etc. But I think a close reading of the life of Yitzhak, we will see in it all of the problems of Jewish life, internal and external. And therefore, that's why it is such an important part of the historiography of the Jewish people, to understand the history and to understand where the Jewish people have been, what problems they have faced, and what their destiny and future is as well.